This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Noelle Lim. The world is facing its worst crisis, the COVID-19 pandemic. Malaysia is not spared. We speak to Tan Sri Dr. Jamilah Mahmud, who is advising the Prime Minister on public health. She is also the founder of Mercy. Thank you for taking time off your busy schedule to speak with us. The key strategies that have been deployed are to physically distance and the three T's, test, trace and treat. I understand Malaysia is testing about 8,000 people per million population. That's lower than South Korea, 13,000, and Singapore, 30,000. Are we testing enough people?
I think it will be a bit higher than that, as we are compiling also the Director General of Health has announced that they're compiling some of the data from private sector that haven't given the negative results. So the numbers will rise. Irrespective, Malaysia's policy is really one of targeted testing. And I think it is it's a sound policy because, if you look at the resources that we have, it may be difficult to, try to test 32 million or even half of that. What is clear is, from the Ministry of Health, they have identified some high-risk groups. And I think what they have also done is in some of the cohorts where they tested, they found that if they're not from high-risk groups, then the positive rate is only about 1%. So with the high-risk groups, they are mainly, number one, the Tablik group, which has already had 5 generations, and the toughest group, some of the areas that have the enhanced MCO, the foreign workers group, and health workers. So these are the groups that you want to really target your testing, and they find that in those groups the rate is about 4 to 5%. Now WHO guidelines is that if you're getting a figure more than 10%, it means you're not testing enough. So 5% pickup rate is, I think, reasonable, taking into consideration everything else.
Suppose at this point of our curve, it makes sense to target the population. What would be Absolutely. A better estimate number then, if it's not 8,000 people per million population?
Ideally, you want to do much more than that, but the lab capacity also has to be optimal. So it's good that now, with more lab facilities, government can test up to about 25,000 soon, and that includes universities, private labs, and so forth. And of course, absolute numbers may not be the best indicator. Malaysia is still doing more tests than any other country in ASEAN.
SOCSO has announced that it is prioritising testing of foreign construction workers as well as security guards working in Selangor and Kuala Lumpur. Mm-hmm. I understand right now testing capacity is about 20,000 per day, and there are 400,000 foreign construction workers. So this is a question that the Builders Association, they have raised. They are estimating it might take 4 to 8 months to complete testing of all their workers and before they can start work. But is that a reasonable estimate? Do you think that this process could be accelerated for them?
I don't have the figures of how many foreign workers are in Reliance Selangor. Obviously, people want to get back to work and industries need foreign workers. I think it's also extremely important for employers to, take a decent history from the worker to find out where they're staying, because, there are areas that are, more at risk than others, making sure they don't have fever, creating an environment that the staff can actually tell you if they're not well. I think this is very, very critical. And then, of course, the testing. I saw in the media that already there's been announced quite a large number of private hospitals that are coming on board to help with testing. So, if we can push the numbers up, if it's estimated that you can push up, say, 25,000 a day, then I don't think it will take 4 to 8 months.
I think it comes down to cost. So free testing is available at SOCSO panel labs like BP Healthcare, but I understand they're all booked up almost till the end of the month. And there are reports that some companies are starting to pay 700 ringgit per worker instead of 300 ringgit simply to expedite testing. And so naturally, they will complain about this. I'm wondering, is the government going to be looking into pricing control, on the fees, on the testing fees?
I don't believe it's 700 ringgit. Even in private center now, you can get it for 300 over ringgit. So if someone is paying 700 ringgit, then there's a problem somewhere. I cannot speak on behalf of the Ministry of Health, but certainly, you know, I will raise it with them, and in fact have raised it with them, that, you know, they have a dialogue with the associations of the private healthcare companies and doctors and labs, so that, you know, we do have some kind of standardization. I don't think it's impossible. The government managed to put a price control on masks. So, you know, it's up to the private healthcare as well to come together. We're talking about large volumes of tests here, right?
One key risk is the undocumented workers. There are many estimates of how many undocumented foreigners that we have in Malaysia. It can go up to more than 3 million people. And the government's recent detention of illegals have been criticised because it might discourage more undocumented workers to come forward if they need to be tested. How best should we manage this situation?
This is very tricky, Noelle. On one hand, you know, what the government was trying to do, and I don't know whether this has been, you know, well understood, is that all the undocumented foreign workers were screened, and they were all, you know, the ones who were positive were taken to Sungai Buloh and other places. But the ones who were negative were tested, I think, twice and brought to a place to be quarantined, so to speak, right? To be kept away, because many of them live in very crowded and housing, and, you know, 20 people or so in one place. In the matter of public safety, I think health safety, you know, they were kept there also to protect them. Now, you know, as with any government, there are immigration laws. So I think I'm not qualified to speak on that on behalf of the government at all. But I think it's a moral dilemma here. Number one, to protect the rakyat and protect the workers themselves. And the other, you know, to look at the immigration laws itself. So it's not an easy, balance to find. But I believe any decision is made in also the best interest of public health.
Will these workers be eventually deported?
You need to ask Immigration Department, because I don't involve myself in that. I focus on the health, the health issues.
How easy are we making it for undocumented workers to come forward?
I think the government made it quite clear that people could come forward and get tested, right? But it might be human nature for people who know that if they get tested and they are negative or they're positive, that there might be a challenge to them remaining in country. What has to happen is the government has to find a balance, right? Number one is to get at public safety and, you know, immigration law, but also look at the human resource needs in the country.
Who covers their medical and testing costs? Is the government going to bear this?
When there was, you know, Selangor mansions and all that, when they sort of cordoned the area, the government tested all of them. They didn't incur a charge to the, you know, migrant.
But if someone volunteers to come forward, he has some symptoms and he's coming forward, what's the policy? Yes. The government will pay for
any,
it?
Any person who has symptoms, you can go immediately to a health facility, a pusat kesihatan, the COVID identified. There are 114 COVID-identified centres in the government that you can get yourself, you know, tested.
So now the unknown factor here is the asymptomatic people and potential hidden clusters and unlinked cases. You know, what are some options the government is considering, like maybe step-up measures to unearth some of these hidden clusters or to track asymptomatic people more closely, potentially?
The tablet cluster, then you will see that the toughest cluster is also linked to the tablet cluster. So it's really circling around the same group. So, you know, being able to identify the chain that is linked to the tablet group is going to be critical. Even with the foreign workers and all that, there's some that also, you know, linked with the tablet group. So this is why, you know, the Ministry of Health's approach to targeted testing is the right one. So it's about really identifying those, you know, high-risk groups that are potentially able to spread within different communities itself.
And so far from testing some asymptomatic people who may have been in the vicinity of the tablet group and or in the toughest, is there something that we can learn why some people have symptoms and some don't have symptoms but may be tested positive?
You know, what the ministry is seeing is only about, you know, less than 20% that have severe disease. Majority have very mild disease or no symptoms at all. More than 80% who will be okay, right? Who have maybe a cold, a cough. So this is why it's hard to pick up, you know, people who may be asymptomatic. I think that we need to behave in a way that really minimizes our contact with others until a vaccine is found. And that's not going to be this year, probably it'll be next year, I hope.
We're speaking with Tan Sri Dr. Jamila Mahmood, Special Advisor to the Prime Minister on Public Health. She's also the founder of Mercy. After this, we'll discuss why it is all right to allow small gatherings during Hari Raya and precautions we should take. Stay tuned.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
This morning, we're speaking with Tan Sri Dr. Jamila Mahmood regarding the fight against COVID-19. She is the Special Advisor to the Prime Minister on Public Health. The government is allowing gatherings of 20 family members only on the first day of Raya and also of 30 people in mosques. In landed property, you might be able to practice reasonable distancing, but in places of communal living like apartments, there might be groups of people coming in. What are your thoughts about this decision? You had tweeted about it.
Yeah, I think people have misunderstood me. First of all, because there's new evidence arising all the time. Korea has this real role model, and then now they're getting this spike because of someone going to some nightclub. As long, it's not the number, Noelle, it's the way we behave. If you live in a small place, then, you know, it's always difficult. But if you're within family, all the family have been together for a long time. So the risk of them actually bringing disease into the family is extremely low. And this is my personal view, is that Raya should be spent only with the family you're with. Irrespective, you know, the whole practice of salam and hugging and kissing and all that is going to be, you know, difficult. And for us Muslims, you know, that's part and parcel of our Raya culture, right? So how do you now convince people that actually it's not such a good idea this year?
Well, not all 20 family members might live together, especially in KL where people tend to live now in smaller units. Some of them are going out to work and then they now all come together in one place. I suppose there's that worry there. And in your tweet, you had said, should we have a lockdown? But you put a question mark. So it's not like, you know, you are putting it up as recommendations.
Absolutely.
So I was just wondering what was behind that tweet.
Sorry, the question mark was to provoke thinking in the public that unless they behave in a way that can protect each other, we're asking for trouble, right? If we don't break the chain, we can never end this until there's a vaccine found.
In terms of procurement, so hospitals at one point were fundraising to get their own personal protective equipment. And when I speak to some of the people who work there, why you need to raise funds, why do you come to the media to get money? And they say there's been a lot of bureaucracy and they've not been able to get funds. There is possible corruption. How are we streamlining the processes to make sure checks and balances are in place and at the same time, hospitals are getting what they need quickly?
You know, I have to say this is under the procurement division of Ministry of Health. I don't interfere with that. And, you know, my role is merely to advise on health generally. So I think that, you know, that's a really good question to ask the Ministry of Health.
So do we still have a shortage of PPEs?
I don't think we have a shortage. There's a constant supply. The DG has explained this many times. You know, they have quite a good online kind of a tracking mechanism where they see how many PPEs come in and out. So there's always, a supply.
The pandemic has really exposed the weaknesses in any country's public health system. So like you mentioned, the UK and the US.
Yeah.
What would be your recommendations now for Malaysia, at least in improving its public health system?
What Malaysia has done right, I will tell you, is that it has learned from its previous experience managing, health crisis from Nipah virus to the SARS and the H1N1 and so forth. So I think that, you know, if there's any one area and lesson that we need to learn is there's never enough preparedness. So this means a real investment in, you know, public health policy on preparedness for health security issues. It means, you know, making sure that you have well-trained staff, clear SOPs, which they had. This is why Malaysia could kickstart and move. You know, Malaysia had 114 COVID centres dedicated to patients who had COVID. Now, I'll give you another comparison. In Italy, when they had this explosion of cases, two provinces, one was Lombardy and the other Veneto, one had a system where there was a specialized COVID hospital that patients go to, and in Lombardy, there was none. That's why you saw an explosion of cases, you know, number of cases in Lombardy compared to Veneto. It's because the system was in place. So we in Malaysia had a health ministry that was proactive, that put in place all the standard operating procedures based on lessons learned from Nipah, from SARS, that, you know, just, you know, went into full swing. And this is why we've been able to manage it.
The government has allocated 500 million ringgit to the Ministry of Health to fight the pandemic. And I suppose this is in addition to 6 billion ringgit that was already allocated from the budget that was announced last year. Is that enough, say, for next year when COVID-19 may still be around?
First of all, we don't know how the progress of COVID is going to be over the next 12 months. But what I do know is that, you know, the government and the Prime Minister himself has very clearly said many times, health is a priority. So if that's where the allocation of budget needs to be, I'm very confident that it will be made available to the Ministry of Health.
Malaysia is involved in the World Health Organization's solidarity trial to test drugs in treating COVID-19. Have we kickstarted any work in Malaysia on this matter?
About more than 100 countries that are, you know, in this trial. So basically, it's a drug trial protocol owned by WHO, where there's four arms, right? There's four drugs. I won't bore you with the names of the drugs. There has been a first patient, there has been a trial already started in Sungai Buloh Hospital. We must laud Malaysia for being selected in this clinical trial, and also because our clinical trial capabilities are there. But we need to also be very cautious that, you know, it's a trial and we need to see whether, you know, the drugs work. This drug called Remdesivir shows no statistical significance in terms of its clinical benefit. So with all drug trials, whether it is for COVID or others, you know, it's a matter of now seeing where the evidence weighs, right? Where it might be useful. I know the Prime Minister was involved with the global meeting, WHO, and really calling for solidarity in terms of vaccine production. So I think this is a very welcome piece of work by WHO, getting scientists to work together, getting governments to work together.
Well, a few names have been bandied around. Could you tell us which are the four most promising drugs and which one has been used in Malaysia?
Four drugs that have been trialed, part of the trial is Remdesivir, Keletra plus interferon, and chloroquine. These are not unknown drugs. Some of them are antiretrovirals that have been used for HIV. Of course, interferon, as you know, is antiviral therapy. Chloroquine is an anti-malarial drug. So far, it's too early to tell whether, you know, any of this work. There's some, you know, new information and evidence emerging that, you know, Remdesivir is not really working so well as we might have thought it to be. Chloroquine doesn't seem to also be, you know, working as well as people think. So, you know, the rest is, I think we have to wait for the end of the trial to see the results.
Will Malaysia look to making some of these vaccines?
I hope so. I think that, you know, if we do manage to create a vaccine, and I'm going to say if, because to date, even SARS virus has no vaccine. It's, you know, the coronaviruses are notorious, right? They are RNA viruses and they are extremely difficult to create a vaccine for. But, you know, on the other hand, I want to be optimistic because we now have a global coalition working together for the creation of the vaccine. So let's hope that it does succeed. If it does succeed, then of course it's in Malaysia's best interest to see if it can be, you know, given the license to actually produce the vaccine, because, you know, as I said, it's public good. Malaysia has been very successful in, for example, hepatitis C treatment, and pushing down the cost of hepatitis C treatment from thousands of dollars to literally hundreds of dollars. So I think, you know, I really hope that, you know, this is an area we can really show some leadership in.
Countries will come together and say, you know, there has to be some reasonable access to vaccines. The reality is Malaysia is going to compete with other wealthier countries, and it's not like our ringgit go as far as their currencies. And the fact that President Donald Trump, you know, all very powerful, he's also trying to get first right of access to these vaccines, and it doesn't help with the trade war that's going on. It might force emerging countries to take sides between US and China just to have access. What do you think could be a reasonable strategy for Malaysia to adopt to really secure our access? Like, for example, should we work with other ASEAN countries, or would that be just too bureaucratic and we should just do it on our own?
You know, this requires what we call, you know, health diplomacy, right? We need to be able to talk to all parties. I do believe, you know, ASEAN, with its very strong convening power, and ASEAN as a bloc, you know, if they come together, could actually have much more negotiation power than one country alone. So, you know, this is, you know, something definitely I would see, you know, ASEAN, you know, probably pursuing.
I wonder, though, how seriously President Trump really takes ASEAN. For example, he has never visited this part of the world.
Well, I think this is the region with the emerging economy. I think any leader would want to come and visit. It's a matter of time.
So my Sejahtera app is administered by the Ministry of Health. Has it been useful in helping the government understand how the virus spreads or how it can guide people's behaviour so that they comply with the CMCO?
I think it's too early days because, number one, we do need a large population of the Malaysian public downloading the app. You know, right now, I think the numbers are quite low, 200 over 1,000. You know, there's three apps. There's MyGra as well, Gra, and there's MyTrace that is much more on, you know, looking at how people, the patterns of movement of people, you know, the tracing abilities as well. What would be good is for the government to, and they are doing it now, to bring this all together into one, you know, very clear tool for the public to be aware of and use. The uptake of these apps have not been as high as we would love them to be. So really a call for people to download them.
COVID-19 has been the canary in the coal mine, I think, for humanity. Mm-hmm. But what should guide us on making trade-offs between lives and livelihoods?
There shouldn't be a trade-off. It's about managing risk. Very clearly, the government has used the WHO guidelines. They are very clear. And the most important thing, of course, is the ability for the health systems to cope and not collapse. And we have a very strong health system. You know, our occupancy rate in our COVID hospitals is only about 15%, which is very good. And then when there's a problem, to have an enhanced MCO, this is exactly what the government is doing. But at the same time, I want to reiterate that it's still, you know, a disease that we don't fully understand, because every day we're learning new things. It's spreading now through the eyes and all sorts of things that are coming out slowly from other countries and research as well. So humility is really needed on all parts, whether it's the government, the private sector and the public, to really be able to continually adapt, adjust. And I think that, you know, only then we can, you know, try to find a win-win situation, right? The transmission of COVID cannot happen with government health systems alone. It is about the public. It really is up to us to stop that transmission and break the chain. Denmark has reopened schools with a R naught of 0.7. You know, we are 0.3 right now. And with an R naught of 0.7, they're able to open schools. The children are disciplined and so forth. So why can't we? Because our public has to prove that it is able to comply with the standard operating procedures. If people are still gathering in groups and going to supermarkets with their babies and all that, we're not going to get there. So it is up to us now to change our behaviours and accept that we are not going to live the way we did before.
Thank you for speaking to me, and go well. Tan Sri Dr. Jamila Mahmood, founder of Mercy and special advisor to the Prime Minister on Public Health. I'm Noel Lim on BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.